from Old Book of Marianas Chena, On Angel's Wings, from 1998. Marianas Chena, On Angel's Wings. First published 1998 in Swedish. Transformed or, sent, from spiritual or fine matter levels on the so-called other side, where the now deceased, Swedish writer, author, Jan Fridegard was the sending station. He Jan Fridegard, 1897-1968, grew up as a farm laborer and tried several professions before the debut of his writings, One Night in July, 1933. His autobiographical novel trilogy about Lars Hard is perhaps his finest work. The death of his father aroused a latent interest in the supernatural, which came to be reflected in The Tower Rooster, 1941. Introduction from the receiving channel on the so-called Earth level, Marianna writes further. When I was asked to write this book, I did not hesitate for a moment. My spaceborn companion, Jan, wanted to recount his personal experiences after his passing, from the moment of death up until now. He is a spirit with his own authoring history during his last incarnation here in Sweden. He is a happy and humorous person, but he also has profound experiences from the cosmic development. When he suggested that the name of this book would be On Angel's Wings, I immediately associated this name with a memory from my childhood. I love watching the sky. Sometimes the clouds are storming in dark flocks, duskily indigo-colored, with violet nuances. Sometimes a clear blue sky shines, covered with fleecy, fluffy, white puffs in enormous patches. When I was a young girl, they were called angel wings. I always tried to catch sight of a real angel among the puffs. Sometimes there were gaps filled with light in the big, dark clouds, and then I believed that within there was a sea of light where angels flew around, looking down through the cloud windows at the silly humans. When they observed all the misery on earth, they closed up the gaps with the down puffs of their angel wings. When I asked Jan if he wanted to tell me about paradise, he laughed heartily and answered, "Paradise, as it is perceived by humans, is not at all what you think. Everyone creates his own paradise, or whatever it is, with his thoughts. I intend to start from the beginning, and the beginning for me means the end of my earthly life and the beginning of life before life." "Are you in paradise?" I asked, somewhat naively. "Oh no, not me," he answered. "Paradise as you see it does not suit a prankster like me at all." He held up a flaming red autumn leaf before my astonished eyes. "This is but a small part of a living code," he continued, "a living code that can shed its form, but which in turn is a part of eternity. The leaf fades, but still lives in full splendor and beauty, just like us humans. The closeness to nature that humanity has lost today is the key to her whole existence. If she loses that key, she will also lose the meaning of her life. She will be trapped in her ego, which will take over her thoughts and actions. She will become a victim of misguided and impure energies. Please let me tell you a story that will be the greatest of all the stories you have heard. Most humans are not only scared of death, they look upon it as a punishment or something horrifying. My hope is that this book will remove such emotions. No one can prove that what I convey through Jen is the truth, but can you really talk about proof in this context? Let us be content with the fact that I am fortunate enough to be the spokeswoman for a soul who has given me the information and inspiration to write On Angel's Wings. Now we are going to listen to Jan's story, a story that he, himself, will tell you from beginning to end. Marianas Chena, 1921-2023. 1. The Crossing. It was a long and laborious step from the grey and poor farm labourer's cottage to the established and rather wealthy author I had become. As an old man, I felt pretty content with my life, especially when I got to bandy words with colleagues and other loose people. I've never been afraid to tell the truth, even if the truth sometimes has been afraid of me. The ugly things in life have danced a waltz with the good and beautiful things, and that has suited me well. I have constructed my books in the same way that you build a stone wall, the biggest stones at the bottom and the smaller ones on the top, with some air in between. I have been a noisy person and I have scolded people until the evil weeds have caught fire. To rub people the right way has never been my style and will probably never become so, not even on the other side of the light portal. If you think I exaggerate on occasions, then I ask the reader to try to understand me. Here I don't live on raw herring and potatoes, here our diet is of a different kind, so I mostly try to be moderate. But it is not small potatoes, as we say in Sweden, that this book will deal with, it is something tremendous and quite inconceivable. It is unbelievable and magnificent. We are going to travel in worlds where only one law applies, the cosmic law. Where the harmonies meet the disharmonies, to be perfected in a minor major chord of fantastic beauty. I have described my latest life on Earth in both autobiographical and educational books. But now I am going to tell you about my real life, the life I was born into the moment I breathed my last sigh on Earth. Now I understand that the miserable life in the farm laborers' cottages wasn't as trying and laborious as it seemed to me at the time. I became at one with nature, as I, day by day, in sunshine and rain, tended my cattle and repaired fences or toiled at the hard soil. I learned to understand all the signs that nature gave me in such ample amount. The different seasons' abundance of new impressions and secrets were imprinted in the farm laborer's open mind, even though he at that point did not fully understand the value of the school he resided in. Mine was the sky, cloudy, clear, or leaden and heavy with rain. Mine was the ground with its riches, even when the snow mercifully hid the deep hibernation of the plants, their struggle for birth, and return to the new spring, to the new, clear light. Mine was the marsh that wetted my tired and dirty feet, friendly in summertime and deceitful in other seasons. The trees were telling me of their fear of being slaughtered by money-mad parasites in human shape, and of their happiness, being able to stretch their crowns towards the sky. Bushes and brushwood told another story of a stinging world, full of hideaways for all sorts of creepy crawlies. It was wonderful to live at that time, but I did not grasp it back then. Much later I became friends with the poor farm boy in me and defended his right to be human in a society where birds of a feather were far from identical. I learned to accept but also to question, not to swallow hook, line, and sinker. The flowers are always to be found in summertime. They wink and flirt with their flower heads from the ditch bank, because they know their place. The country road must be free of flowers. There the traffic shall rush by without seeing them. They exist, but they must not disturb the cold, grey stretch of smooth gravel or asphalt. It is the same in life. The flowers are to be found at the side of the road. The question is whether you should take your time to stop and pick some of them, without ruining the wholeness of the landscape. I think it's necessary that you do so, otherwise life will be transformed into an eternal freeway, without dreams and without beauty. But now we are going to talk about my birth into a completely different life. I closed my eyes in my earthly life and stepped straight into the next one. That's what I am going to tell you about. From the first moment of my last breath. How strange. I was breathing and felt bright and breezy. Yet, I was lying like some kind of graven image in my bed. I looked at myself and wasn't happy about what I saw. The old man has really aged, I thought, and is as ugly as sin. Once I was a handsome man. No, I was not, I am. Where did this certainty come from, that I am what I am, now? I turn my eyes from the old man Jan in the bed and discovered a thin, shiny, silvery thread running between him and me. Exactly like a dog's leash, I thought, and I laughed out loud. But the man at the other end of the leash did not laugh. He was lying there, as if dead, and suddenly I realized that that was exactly what he was, dead. Then who was I? To be sure, I was him before, but now I am him, too. Well, occasionally you have read about things like that. Jan's spirit, that was me. I did not feel any different, but I was very curious. Jand was dead, long live Jan. The dog's leash was fixed. It is usually called the silver cord. I knew very well that I had to endure it for about 3 days. After that it would loosen by itself, like the umbilical cord of a newborn baby. In fact, I had read a lot about what happens after death. But now, when I was there myself, in the middle of the unknown, I felt a bit uncertain. What does an Earth human really know about life after this, about life between lives? There are plenty of theories, such I have kept in abundance. But where should I go now? Where was the borderline between theory and knowing? People came into the room where the dead Jan lay, the dead Jan, who was alive. I recoiled and discovered that the silver cord could be stretched. I went out through the wall, and I thought a bit sarcastically about my book called The Tower Rooster. Would I do the same thing as the old man in the book, mostly hang on the outside of the tower, or would I get to do a longer journey? In that case, how was that to be managed? A pair of hands clutched mine. I was lifted through walls and roof, and I caught a glimpse of a large entity dressed in white that pulled me with him, her, gently but resolutely. The dog leash was still there, but I did not care, because it obviously could be stretched quite a long way. We flew through the air like in some science fiction novel. Maybe there was some truth in such novels, I thought, who used to write very down-to-earth prose myself. I did not see any church towers and neither any landscape, the way you see it from an airplane. Maybe the clouds surrounded us, maybe it was some other fog, because my sight wasn't clear. It grew dark now, and it felt as if we were going through a tunnel. I closed my eyes. The hands of the unknown entity still clasped mine in a firm grip, and strangely enough, it felt safe and pleasant. I couldn't help pondering over what was now happening to the other Jan, the one down on Earth. Was he to be buried in the cold soil or to be consumed by the flames of fire? Maybe it was more pleasant not to know. I decided to leave myself entirely in the hands of this being, who I understood must be an angel. Unless I hadn't gone astray or down the wrong track, of course. I couldn't help smiling at that black-edged thought, and at that precise moment we landed. I opened my eyes, slightly afraid of being surrounded by a burning Jaina. Instead, there was a vast plain where shapes were flashing by, thin and transparent, like vague figures. Oh, I see, I thought a bit gloomily. First you get to a kind of preliminary stage of purgatory. After that it's all downhill, of course. But it probably serves me right. Do I look like those? I asked, and pointed at some ghost-like shapes gliding by. Not at all, answered my winged companion with a smile. You look more like me. I looked more closely at her. She was dressed in a long, pale garment. She had blonde hair that reached her waist. Her large eyes were dark blue, like a summer night's sky. She did not seem as huge any longer, as I had first imagined. Or perhaps she had shrunk after our swift journey? She wasn't transparent, but she gave an impression of lightness and liveness. I looked at my hands. They were still my hands, although softer and smoother. My name is Chilith, and I am your guardian angel, she continued. Jan, your physical body is dead, but you are alive. As long as the silver cord still remains between you and your earthly body, your eyes will be veiled. When it is broken, we will see where your free will leads you. I will remain with you for some time yet, but the day will come when you won't need me anymore. Where are you going, then? I wondered curiously. I will receive new tasks. The angel answered evasively. She still held onto my hand. It felt like a firm grip. As my father used to say, he judged people by their handshake, and he couldn't be bothered with what he called a woman's handshake. They feel like dead herrings, was his rather harsh judgment. I experienced an intense longing for him. Why did not he meet me here, with his coarse humor and boisterous laughter, to show me around in heaven? In case this was heaven, of course. It was a bit too primitive, in my opinion. And a little too foggy. I wasn't yet entirely sure whether I had ended up in purgatory, which the priests have such a good hang of. Perhaps the priest at home in Uppsala was preaching about purgatory at my funeral right now? It would not surprise me, when considering how many bad words I have mentioned about priests. This is only the beginning, Jan, and not the beginning you think, the angel girl said, smiling gently. It will feel different when the cord has come loose. Part of you is still on earth. This is not what you would call heaven. Is there really a heaven? I asked, a bit mockingly. There are many. Jilith replied, and it flashed in the depths of her blue sea eyes. Just wait, and you'll see. Facing this bait, I had to surrender. In my entire earthly life I had been curious about what happens after death, and now here I stood completely dead on a foggy plain, holding hands with a beautiful girl, while faceless. Shadows were gliding past like a shoal of eels, seemingly without a goal in this colorless existence. Am I going to live here with the shadows? Who are they? I couldn't help but ask. My angel girl was sweet as candy, her blonde hair and rosy cheeks could have been painted by Botticelli. Was I dreaming? Was I really dead? Was this something that you used to call purgatory down on earth? No, my friend, she answered my unspoken question. The shadows you see haven't liberated themselves from their earthly bonds, although their silver cords were loosened long ago. They are earthbound souls who are mourning their former existence. Some of them are lost, some of them are discontented and disappointed, and some of them are chained to their own sins and misfortunes. They refuse to move on. But I want to move on, my beautiful Beatrice. I jested, and my bright companion smiled openly and warmly. We looked at each other in mutual understanding, but suddenly Jilith pricked up her ears. She grabbed my arm and pulled me some distance away. The fog grew denser and rolled itself around us like a thick, grayish-white spiral. Now you have become free from the silver cord, the angel exclaimed. We can continue now. That certainly got on fast, I pointed out. Never have 3 days and nights disappeared so quickly. Time does not exist here, Jilith objected. 3 days and 3 nights have passed on Earth. Can you understand that? I have been given the signal for us to proceed now. The poor shadows you see here don't want to listen to their guardian angels. They prefer to wander about, homeless, as vague shapes until they understand that they have their free choice to evolve in a new world. Sometimes they are drawn by their own longing back to Earth. They cannot stay there, but they willingly wander about in the surroundings of their old life perpetually. Is that what we call ghosts or lost souls? I wondered. Yes, they are the visible invisible ones, was the answer. They can actually mentally influence humans in the surroundings they choose to haunt, whether they appear in dreams or show themselves in some other way. Sometimes the longing and the love for their old environment gives them an influence of positive force, but mostly this influence is negative, due to its own limitation and the fear response from its old surrounding. But now you have to proceed, if you don't want to stay here among the shadows. Of course, I didn't. Nevertheless, it might have been fun to haunt some people I knew, my publisher and some of my old friends. Certainly they stood there at my graveside, hats in hand, and certainly they were drinking at least a couple of funeral feasts in my honor. But of course I was more curious to find out what was waiting for me a bit higher up or further away, whichever it was. In the cloudy spiral, Jilith started to grow. She took me in her arms, where I rested as on eiderdown. At the same time, it felt as if I was lying in a mother's womb with labor pains. I was infinitely small and curious about the world outside. Then all became dark for a moment, or for an eternity. Is there any difference in this state? Chapter 2. My Joyful Valley. When I awoke, life was smiling at me. Because what else other than life could bring me to such an idyllic place? I wanted to laugh out loud and dance around with my beautiful angel, who again was small and dainty. She smiled and said, "Do it. Dance with me." So we took a turn round on a sun-drenched flowery meadow, where fragrances and music seemed to be one, where the air vibrated with tones enclosing us in a breathlessly lovely embrace. We were as light as the air, but still I felt how my feet touched the dew-glittering grass and how my right arm rested firmly around Jilith's slender waist, while my left hand held her little hand in a warm and almost physical grip. It was a long time since I had been able to dance, and I enjoyed the clear tones from the invisible musicians and the pleasure of the frisky windborne dance. "Well, that's that," Jilith commanded in a determined tone. "Now we must proceed. We've just danced into the valley where your last life began. Look around you. Intoxicated by dance, music, and fragrances, I had totally forgotten to watch for where I was. I saw high mountains surrounding us in a closed circle. They were covered with moss and flowering trees in splendid colors, but their peaks were bare and shone in a wondrous way. It was as if the mountains had halos. All Saints' Mountains," I thought, with a smile. A river murmured forward in capricious nooks, until it tumbled in wild delight over a precipice and became a magnificent waterfall. Everywhere succulent, brilliantly colored vegetation was seen. An earthly landscape in sublime form. "From here you decided to return to Earth and live your last life there," the angel explained. "Here you have often resided between lives, because you are a part of this valley. You are the grass and the flowers, and the trees. You are the silent, watching mountains and the water that flows in gentle streams until it throws itself out into the creation of your next life. You have always loved this place, and still you don't recognize it?" "Oh yes," I answered, amazed. "Now the memory is coming back to me. Here is my origin in my joyful valley. But how could I ever leave this paradise to go to hell on earth?" "You had to," sighed my guardian angel. "You chose it because the experiences that your earthly life gave you were a condition for the path that you will walk now." "Well, walk? Can I no longer decide for myself? I want to stay here. Who makes my decisions?" "You have already a long time ago chosen to return to your origin, in order to bring your experiences from many lives and many worlds. Your own inner self makes your decisions, but the Great Spirit shows the way. Our dance was the joyful confirmation of the beginning of your new walk of life. Feel how life is flowing inside you. In other words, the dance of circulation." I laughed, and spun the girl round once more. "Are we going to stay here, or do we move on?"
"We have stayed here for a moment of eternity," Jilith pointed out. "Now you will meet one of the counselors who will accompany you for a very long time." She floated towards one of the high mountains. I floated after her as well as I could, perhaps a little reluctantly. The more I saw, the more I wanted to see of this place. Why such a hurry? What kind of person had I been the last time I was here? How did I look? How did I think? Did I myself really choose to go down to Earth in the guise of a poor farm boy? Okay, perhaps it had been good for me not to be born to a snob. I wonder how I would have coped with that? I laughed at the thought and turned around to enjoy the brilliant panoramic view. Then I heard a deep man's voice saying, "Well, Jan, you became a cultural snob anyway." I turned around in surprise. In front of me stood a tall male figure in a light yellow cloak. His hair was white as snow, but his face was young and smooth. His profile was clear-cut. His features were chiseled as by a Hellenic artist and his dark blue eyes were deep and full of life. He looked at me searchingly, but with a friendly smile. I instinctively felt that he had a deep fund of humor. "It's time for you to be confronted with yourself," he continued. "What you have been and what you are will together form what you become."
"Aha, the Akashic Records," I exclaimed. "This is where all one's stupid things are revealed, isn't it? May I ask who you are?"
"My name is Zar," he answered, and his eyes flashed. "Stupid things are not the only things you did, my friend. I will be your leader and teacher as long as you need me. The Akashic Records, see the cosmic map at the end of this book, is a kind of intermediate stage between two worlds. Everybody must experience it. Afterwards it is decided which world you belong to, so we'd better get it over and done with. The walls of the mountain we had reached rose almost perpendicularly up to the sky. I still remember the lovely sunsets over the forested peaks of my childhood mountains. Here it was even more beautiful. The sky above the mountain glowed and adopted a most exquisite color of rose red and salmon pink with a touch of glittering gold. The man at my side touched the mountain with a staff. The mountain wall started to shake, and raised itself like a theater curtain. There was a small room behind it. It was furnished with comfortable chairs in front of what looked like an enormous movie screen, which went from wall to wall. The room was lit by a soft, pleasant light. Jilith brought me to an armchair and then she sat down on my right side while Zar sat to my left. Between us and the screen was a little podium with a lighted floor. From somewhere, soft music streamed out into the room. "Are you ready?" asked Zar. "You have to be prepared for both pleasant and less enjoyable meetings. The main character here is the truth that has followed you through thousands of years. The truth about the country bumpkin Jan," I chuckled. "Go ahead. I know for sure what a rogue and rascal I have been." Zar gave me a peculiar look. "Well, we do know that you like that rogue and rascal," he said. "To like oneself is an important quality for one who creates. How else do you think you would have become such an appreciated author? Soon we will see if Jan the human is a reflection of Jan the author, or vice versa. We will see what you regret and what you will forgive in yourself." I was just about to give him a sharp retort of what I regretted the most, something about beautiful women and seizing the opportunity, when suddenly the movie screen darkened. There was lightning and thunder, the rain was lashing over us in there inside the mountain room, but we did not get wet. We were sitting dry-shod in an unparalleled storm. The moist mountain walls were lit up by the flashes, and the granular surface of the walls sparkled as if it was sprinkled with diamonds. "Raise your consciousness," Zar ordered, and put his hand over mine. Suddenly I felt how my earthly thoughts disappeared and my whole inner self experienced a euphoric feeling of light and radiant colors, a happiness so great that tears of joy rolled down my cheeks. The storm had ceased and I saw the meadows and the forests of my childhood on the movie screen. I saw my mother giving birth to me and my father who was standing next to her chewing his mustache, proud and scared. Proud to have yet another son, but scared that my mother's strengths would diminish. But everything went well. I saw myself grow up, my life as a man with his own family, wife, son, and daughter. I cried, felt ashamed, rejoiced, boasted of the good things in life, was appalled at the dark sides, happy to have come through them not taking them too seriously. "What a life," I moaned during the breaks of laughter and tears. "Can you be forgiven such folly? Can you forget such injuries? Can you manage to proceed with that burden on your frail back?" "Your back is strong, Jan," answered Zar. "Now take your opportunity to say hello, because the meetings will be very short." My mother, my father, and my beloved little sister were standing on the podium. They were as ethereal as I was, but when I rushed over to hug them, their bodies felt warm and substantial. All the time I had thought that I and everyone else were talking in the usual way. Not until now did it dawn on me in my poor head, nobody was moving their mouths, neither Zar, the angel, father, mother, nor my sister. "How about me?" I was talking feverishly with my beloveds, but when I put my finger against my mouth, my lips weren't moving. This was a shock. But when I saw the faces of my beloveds, I realized that they, too, had made the same remarkable discovery. At first I felt like a ventriloquist, but when my father laughed his boisterous laugh without making any noise, I understood that this new body did not work in the same way as the old, worn-out one. Unfortunately, the secure, well-known figures disappeared before I even had time to finish thinking. But new ones arrived. Human after human with more or less familiar faces from my life on Earth made their appearance on the podium. Some of them scolded me, and then I enjoyed uncontrollably the fact that their mouths did not move. Wrongs, fights, and insolences filed past.